Hello everyone and welcome to a new episode of an Impact Pool podcast. And today I'm here with Olufemi Elias. He's currently judge for administrative tribunals, visiting professor in international law at Queen Mary University of London, and also a musician. Welcome, Femi.
Good morning, good afternoon, Malai.
It's morning for you in Washington, D.C., yes.
Indeed, indeed. And early afternoon for you.
Yep, correct. Yes. Well, great to have you on the podcast. I'm really excited that you wanted to do this. Just to give it a bit of context, I think we know each other from working both at the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, where I think you worked in two capacities, once as a senior legal officer, and later you came back to be the director of the legal office. Let me kick off, maybe. Can you just briefly tell us what your road in life has been up to date and how it influenced the work that you're doing at the moment?
Thank you, Alain. Once again, thank you for having me here. My life story. I'm Nigerian, was born in Nigeria, grew up there, went to school there. My family is a family of lawyers. Both my parents, my two brothers and my two sisters, we are all lawyers. Probably reveals a bit of a lack of imagination, but in terms of me being a lawyer myself, I have to say it's not really something I ever thought about. Mm-hmm. It's almost like I assumed that's what people did when they grew up. Everybody became a lawyer when they grew up. So I wouldn't say it's a decision. As I just said, I never really thought about it. I just went into it because that's just what I thought people did. And I have absolutely no regrets about that. I'm very, 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 very happy I did that. I really enjoy the law. International law is something that I particularly enjoyed. None of my other siblings are international lawyers at all. All went down different routes. And as a public international lawyer, two obvious kinds of job that one would be or would fall into is academia or international organizations. And I am, you know, happy to say that I've been able to keep a hand in both for most of my career. And I think that's really the central background of why I ended up doing the things that I've done in my career.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And from that career so far, what would you... I mean, what would you be most... I don't want to say proud of, but what did you find most interesting so far, if you could pick something?
I think if I had to put it in one sentence, it's that I have been able to see how international law, international legal principles play a role in efforts to make the world a better place. I had to put it very, 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 very generally. That's the real idea. From nitty-gritty discussions between countries, seeing the origins of initiatives that end up in concrete decisions which are intended to have positive effects on the international community. That's what I've really enjoyed the most. It's not often that it happens. It's not, you know, there are always discussions and negotiations to be had. There are always interests to be accommodated. So it doesn't always go exactly one wants. But having seen some of that, varying degrees of closeness and understanding how it works is something I have really enjoyed. You know, the intellectual curiosity and interest in a subject and seeing how, even though sometimes only to a limited extent, that translates into practice for the greater good. That's what I've enjoyed the most about it. That whole effort.
Okay.
Well,
I can understand that. Yeah. Hey, I'm curious to know what has been a leading threat, so to speak, in your career decisions. I mean, what elements have been or are deciding factors for you in terms of what you've been doing?
Again, it's essentially the interest in in the subject matter of the mm-hmm. particular job. Initially, the first 8-9 years of my career, I was an academic in the United Kingdom. I was teaching international law. Then thereafter, I joined the United Nations. I joined the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or MNU. Then I went to work with the World Bank. Then I went back to the UN, working on international criminal tribunals. And now, sitting as a judge in a number of administrative tribunals, it's always been different facets, different aspects of how international law operates in international organizations, and how, you know, the particular subject matter of each job, you know, seeks to just make things better in the work that it does. That's what's always driven me in the jobs I've gone for. Of course, you know, on a more practical, mm-hmm. pragmatic level, you know, there are things to think about progressing in one's career from one level to another. Those have also been relevant. Let's keep it real a little bit. It's not just always, you know, one has to think about those things as well. And then in the course of my career, having a family, you know, can't keep moving them all over the place all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, one has to balance all those things. So while one has the ideal situation of an interesting job which one seems qualified for and is successful in getting and is able to contribute in that position, one has to be realistic, has to balance that with real life. One has to keep the job, and one has a family and other obligations that one has to, you know, bear in mind. So all of those things feed into the decisions one makes, mm-hmm. the decisions I have made in my career.
Okay. Hey, you spoke about it already a bit. You've presumably delivered many lectures, and I saw, you know, wrote some books and definitely articles. Can you expand a little bit on the fascination you have when it comes to the legal system that applies to international organizations? I mean, again, you could have chosen different directions, you know, and you were the only one going this direction in your family. So mm-hmm. why that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, other members of my family, I mean, my father was an international lawyer as well, but my siblings are all commercial lawyers, private lawyers, corporate lawyers, all doing different kinds of law. Mm-hmm. And this is what fascinated me. Like I said, I studied law. I did a master's in international law after my first degree. I did a PhD in international law, all on, you know, methodological aspects, how international law is made, how it's generated, you know, some foundational questions. So these are always been things that fascinated me, about how international law is made, its binding force, how it compels states, to what extent it compels states in a practical sense. These are all things that I've always been fascinated by. Now, from that context, the role of international organizations in making states act in a particular way towards particular objectives defined by that international organization has always been particularly fascinating. It relates to what I was saying before. I have to see an idea, a result, creation to fruition, kinds of cooperation, multilateralism, and how one goes from the idea to its implementation. That is something I've always found fascinating. And that's why the idea of lawmaking and the generation of law is something that has always fascinated. So that's like something I've spent time on in my various academic studies.
But okay. Now, I'm not a lawyer, clearly.
Quite clearly.
Well, we had some chats about law, and I always enjoyed that, you know, in my work in HR, although HR and the lawyers are always on different sides of the coin, or not always. They tend to be somewhat sometimes on the different side.
Sometimes.
But when you're dealing with admin tribunals, is that largely then internal disputes, or how should I see that? Because you're now referring to states and this is more like internal looking.
Yes. Again, one has to situate these tribunals in the larger context of international organizations and what they do.
Right.
The international in the world. International organizations are creatures of the law, are creatures of a treaty. A treaty is an agreement between different sovereign countries. That's one of my particular interests in international law. It's the law of treaties, which is what international organizations are usually based on. Most of them are created by a treaty.
Yeah.
Now, when you have an organization created by a treaty is an act of sovereign entities who are all equal. This means that any international organization cannot be subject to the laws of just one of them. Most international organizations, not even most, an international organization has to be located somewhere, because international organizations are not countries. They don't have territory. If an international organization is located somewhere, the natural tendency would be for the laws of that place to influence it. But that must be resisted, because it's not subject to the laws of that country just because it's based there. It's still an international entity which has an international character and is created by a treaty between sovereign equals. Therefore, the OPCW, with its headquarters in The Hague, is not subject to Dutch law in its core operations under its treaty.
No.
The UN is not subject to US law in terms of its headquarters in New York. The World Bank is not subject to the laws of Washington, D.C. in terms of its operations. So it has to retain an international character. So if you have a problem with any of these organizations, where do you take them? Where do you sue them? You can't sue the OPCW before the Dutch courts because it's not subject to Dutch law.
No.
So where would you sue them? How can you get accountability in a judicial sense for these international legal entities? The way it works is that all international organizations submit to an international administrative tribunal so that they can have accountability for people who need to sue them. Particularly within Europe, under the European Convention of Human Rights, they are required to do that in practice, because the European Convention of Human Rights, which is applicable all over Europe, guarantees a right to a fair trial for everybody in the territories of the countries in which it applies. Therefore, international organizations have to provide access to justice for their staff. And when it comes to staff cases, when internal staff want to sue the organizations for bad treatment, unfair dismissal, or what have you, they come to these administrative tribunals. So these administrative tribunals serve an important role, and it's one avenue through which people can have access to justice against international organizations. So in that regard, yes, they are internal. It's mainly staff employment cases. There are other mechanisms for other kinds of cases to hold international organizations accountable. And this is just one of them. But in the bigger context, it goes down to the question of the immunity of international organizations and accountability of international organizations, and how to make sure international organizations are good citizens in international society, as it were.
Yeah, that's a nice one. They have to be good citizens.
Yes, very well. They have to be. They're too important in the international community not to be good citizens.
No, exactly.
They lead the way in so many important respects. They preach rule of law. They preach good governance. The least they can do is practice what they preach.
Exactly. And this, yes,
in a small way, such administrative tribunals are an element of that good accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, something totally different. Yes. As far as I know, and of course this goes to my heart, being a musician myself, you've always kept playing the bass guitar. I think we even played once at my house, actually. I remember that.
We did. Yes. Only once, unfortunately.
Only once, yeah. We still have to play somewhere. But I think no matter whichever position you've held, you've been playing. Why have you kept playing, and what does music mean to you as a person?
Oh, music's very important. I can't imagine not playing music. I can't imagine not having music in my life. It's something I've always been interested in. I started playing. one must have been about 10 or 11. Started playing the guitar, and then I moved on to the bass guitar, and then the double bass, you know, formally.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always continued playing all through my life. You know, I have several instruments. I've always enjoyed it. Of course, it's quite clear that my legal career has taken precedence. But I've also always maintained a musical career. There's a group of musicians I've always played with for many years. You know, mm-hmm. I can't always do concerts, but whenever I am available, room is made for me. You know, I'm accommodated because I know all the songs, because I do a lot of writing with the band leader as well, who again was another childhood friend of mine.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if my place in the band is almost guaranteed whenever I have the time. So that's a nice position to be in.
That's a really good position to be in, yeah.
It is. And because we're, you know, as I said, because we write most of the music together, I'm often not lost. I know most of the songs, so that's good. But yes, it's something I've always done. It was always the real, like I said, it hasn't really been that much of a dilemma because, you know, the legal career has always been the main thing.
Mm.
I don't think it was ever an actual decision that I made. That's just how it's turned out.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one thing I will always have in my mind is, what if I had chosen to go down the music route instead?
Yeah, I was going to ask, obviously.
Yes.
Why not?
Well, yeah, good question. Like I said, it's not really something I really thought about as such. And being able to, you know, satisfy that need.
Because you're actually good as a bass player. So I remember hearing you from the first time. I mean, whatever it means coming from me. I was like,
thank you.
Geez, the guy really plays really good. What is he doing here?
it certainly means a lot to me. Well, thank you very much for saying that. The interesting thing is that I'm running through my head. Only yesterday, I was listening to a book launch there in The Hague at the Permanent Court of Arbitration, no less,
mm-hmm.
by a very distinguished international lawyer. I won't reveal his name. The senior person. We're colleagues. He's a fantastic jazz drummer.
Okay.
I like his band very much. He works there in an international institution there in The Hague. And he's in a band, which I saw play, full of other senior international civil servants in The Hague. Really? Excellent jazz band.
Oh, wow.
And then it just reminds me, another colleague, who's also a bass player, worked in a few of the international organizations in The Hague, is now based in Europe, another great bass player. And I can think of two others. And these are also senior international civil servants in different international organizations everywhere. All keeping the music going. And those are only the ones I know. I'm sure there are many, many.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of people that doing a lot of things.
Absolutely. And this is what I was going to come down to. You know, because we work in international organizations, no matter what level we get to, doesn't mean we're not normal people. Everybody has things they like. You know, it could be, you know, everybody has serious hobbies. You know, I think it can't be a question of having, you know, two careers at the same time, because I'm sure we'll run into contractual issues as international civil servants. I'm not sure.
What would be music? And I don't know, it depends.
Your contract of employment allows you to be doubling up with visa issues and special, you know, status as international civil servants under the laws of the host country, etc. There are many things to look at there. It could be an outside activity.
Could be, yes.
You see, so there are many issues there. But without going down that route, if it were to be a career, then you would have to deal with things like that.
Mm.
But the fact is, just because we're international civil servants, we don't stop being normal people with normal interests. You know?
Yeah.
And let me put it this way. This wouldn't even be an issue at all. If, for instance, what if one were a concert pianist or a classical violinist? Maybe that would be considered more acceptable.
Would it
that
be,
would have raised so many eyebrows as if you were in a blues band or
heavy metal
rock band, heavy metal, exactly. So yeah, I don't think those things should get in the way. International civil servants are normal people, normal interests, with a different kind of music that they might want to play, including other kinds of self-expression that they might have. And I don't see what or why anyone should consider any of those things necessarily of itself incompatible with one's status as a good and highly functioning international civil servant. I say the more musicians out there, the better. That's what I say.
I agree with you. Yes,
I do.
But yet there are people.
Rather fine pianist yourself, I may say so.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, I think I have the experience that people always really, really appreciated it. But I did hear you sometimes say, although, okay, you just said, well, you didn't really run into issues, but that sometimes, especially when you were, I guess, the registrar or how would you call that? The assistant secretary general level, I think that is, a major UN institution that some people might go, well, really? I mean, you can't
it's
be in
possible,
a band now.
You know, I've heard some people say, really? Really? And you're an SC and you're playing in a band? And my thought was always, yeah.
So, doesn't that make me serious?
So, exactly.
It's good for the brain work, for one thing. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
Of course
no, I think that the point for me here, I think, is also that, you know, for people also listening, I run into quite some people that have if they want to join the UN or, you know, similar organizations, they feel that they have to be in a certain way. And I think if we're talking more broadly about diversity in the broadest sense, why if you're good at your job and you have other things that you bring to the table as well, you don't have to fit into a box. Or I don't think so.
I don't know why we're even talking about boxes.
Yes,
like I said, human beings do different things.
Exactly.
Simple as that. I don't see why it really shouldn't be an issue. Like you said, I know people have commented on it before. People have made an issue of it. I just think it's very odd.
Then you should have played the violin. They were all fine. No, I'm joking.
Yeah. I guess it depends what you do. But the fact that you take your music very seriously, I don't see why that should raise any concerns in and of itself.
I think it's really, I think it's good if people do different things. It makes you... It gives you different perspective also on the work that you actually do, and it can enrich it, in my view. Hey, speaking of boxed in thinking, back in the day, at the OPCW, we've had some, offline discussions about, in terms of hiring of staff and the restrictive framework that exists within the UN common system. And sometimes led, especially on my side, to frustrations when trying to recruit certain people. What are your thoughts on that today? I mean, I personally think, I would hope something would change there or we get more flexibility at one point. I can see that's going to be hugely difficult, but I don't know. I'm curious to hear your view.
Yeah, this is a challenge. It's a challenge for sure, because... I mean, it must exist even in the private sector as well, but definitely public sector in bureaucracies like the ones in which we work, like the ones in which you find in international organizations. There are rules, there are very clear requirements, and there is not as much room for maneuver as someone in your line of work. Talent management, talent acquisition will always come up against, and which we, people in my line of work, lawyers, judge in an administrative tribunal, international organizations, will always come, I have to deal with, because there have to be rules, they have to be objective, you have to protect international civil servant. And that in many ways translates into a lack of flexibility. There have to be standard job requirements, standard experience requirements. And that therefore limits the amount of flexibility that you can. And if you don't do it, you know, people will seek redress, address grievances regarding to that. You have to explain how you made the decision, on what basis you made the decision.
Mm.
And it's always going to be difficult. It's going to be easier to say, this person ticks all the boxes on this job description that has done this for many years, than it is to say, oh, this person looks brilliant. I like some of their ideas, even though they haven't done quite so much. I think they could be good. Let's take a chance on them.
Mm.
No, the former is always going to sound more convincing. As I said, it doesn't matter what line of work it is, you know, experience and things like that are always easier. But in our particular context, it's a challenge that I can imagine people in your line of work always come up against. And there are examples where it might not look good. I think in a previous discussion, you'd given me the example of someone like, you know, very senior politicians in the world. You remember?
Oh, you mean President Obama?
Yes, that example. That example. That,
well, I don't know if it holds true, but we were thinking.
I'm sure it's not true. It was a bit of an exaggeration. But the point remains.
The point remains
that you can have this flashy job, big important position elsewhere, particularly based on democracy, people vote for you.
Yeah.
But if you came to the UN and applied for a job, you probably wouldn't be good enough because the number of years and.
Yeah, well, then I have another example. I was just watching on Netflix this documentary about Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, by the way, then became governor.
Yes, of course.
I mean, that's a great example of, well, you know, no experience in the field whatsoever, but he became governor. You cannot think of that within the UN.
I don't think he just became governor. I don't think most people would say he was a bad governor.
I don't think so.
This is the point.
Yeah, exactly.
If he went there and did a terrible job, then...
then everybody would see.
Everything he was saying, exactly. But the fact is, he really wasn't a bad governor, like most. So the question is, how much innovation and flexibility can you come up with in a setting like those of international organizations?
Yeah. Well, I would think that, you know, if you come up with a different sort of framework within your recruiting, which allows for, I don't know, a certain strict methodology in terms of testing people's competencies or something, so that there at least is a measurable basis that, you know, coming back to your point in terms of potential litigation or people have a grievance, you could say, well, look, we followed this methodology and there we saw X and this candidate is Y, so we chose X because that suited better in terms of the job. And you can substantiate that. That might be in the future maybe a way out, I'm thinking. I think in the UNDP they do something similar a little bit.
Yes, there are two aspects to it. One of them is the question of a challenge to any decision you take, and what ultimately, say, an administrative tribunal, for instance, would be looking for is a measurable basis for your decisions. You need to be able to say the decision was based on X, Y, and Z. Not that the tribunal has to agree with your decision, no, but you have to show that it was taken on a recognized and reasonable basis. That's one side. But what I think might be even trickier, and that can be addressed, as you say, by coming up with an acceptable matrix, acceptable framework for testing, you know, an innovative way of creating things, matching people's skills to a particular job, rather than just what degrees you have and how long you've worked. Even though those things are obviously important as well.
Yeah, sure. I'm not dismissing it.
All of that on one side. But what I think will be the bigger challenge beyond devising those methods and making sure that the decisions are defendable is cultural. By cultural, I mean how institutions think, how you are going to sell these ideas to the ultimate policymakers and decision makers that, you know, this innovative way of thinking is actually solid, how to convince them that it works, how to convince them that you're not coming up with newfangled ideas, you know, new way of thinking. Because, yeah, it's that kind of being in an organization, being in its own comfort zone, that is the biggest challenge that I find.
Yeah,
and that's what I mean when I say cultural. So I have to persuade people that, you know, this needs to be done. These are the advantages. I think a very solid case has to be made. And I think that is something that I think people in your line of work must find quite challenging. And I can imagine this could be a very rewarding thing as and when you pull it off.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Hey, usually we've got a lot of people within Impact Pool that are searching the job market and are interested potentially also to work, you know, as a legal expert. Right. But what I also remember, especially at in The Hague, where there's lots of lawyers, recruiting them at least finding enough suitable candidates, speaking of criteria, wasn't usually the issue. But with all that competition for people applying, what advice would you give to potential job seekers if they want to apply for a legal role in the broadest sense in one of the international organizations?
First bit of advice. In addition to having all the requirements, which itself is not a small thing, because I say in addition to, as if it's, you know.
No, exactly.
Everybody's qualified these days. So many people have so many good qualifications. Everybody has a master's degree. I don't know whether there are many professional level jobs in the UN that don't require a master's degree anymore. As a starting thing, certainly the legal field.
Yeah.
In addition to the academic qualifications and the relevant years of relevant legal experience, I think a really important thing is to have a bit of a thick skin. You have to be persistent. I applied for many, many jobs when I first started thinking about working for the UN. I didn't even hear back at all. Of course, recruitment processes and things are a little bit different now, as we're talking 30 plus years ago now, the first time I started applying. But I think you must not be discouraged by those things. You have to persist. You have to keep applying. Do internships at the earliest stages of your career, whatever internships you can find. Many of them are not paid, many organizations.
No.
But some are. Some are. In the UN system, they're not paid, but in other institutions, they are. Do as many of those as you can. Attend events, scholarly societies focusing on international law and the law practiced by international organizations. Stay in the know, make as many contacts as you can, which again comes down to what I said, just be persistent. Be persistent. You have to be persistent because there are just so many well-qualified people out there. If you have the goods, you're well qualified, you're a good, decent lawyer, keep doing it, and the chances of it working out one day are great. Persistence is the main thing I would advise. Don't give up so easily because the competition is just so fierce.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
That would be my real advice.
Yeah. Do you have any personal trait that's been critical in your professional journey? If you look upon it, think, that has been a leading threat.
Personal trait. I like people. I like working with people.
Okay. Yeah.
I enjoy learning. I enjoy learning from people. You know, and we have people who are serious about what they do, who are good about what they do, who are committed in what they do, are people who have a good mind, who want to do good things, not to make themselves look good or make themselves sound important or to wield power. No, those things for me are real turn-offs. I enjoy people who are good at what they do and who want to share that knowledge for achieving a good common purpose. And so liking people who do that, wanting to be around them, always willing to learn from people like that. I don't know. I don't know whether that's helped me what I do. I know that's something, that's a trait I have.
Yeah, yeah, it's a drive for you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a trait that I have. I don't know the extent to which it has been instrumental in all the decisions I've made. I'll need to go and think about that one again. But I think that's important. I think wanting to learn, wanting to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
To improve things in the context in which one is working, I think that's an important trait that has always guided me.
That's a nice one. I'm getting to the end of the questions that we sort of thought of. I mean, could you share a wish right now for what you would like to bring to the world? What would that be?
Oh man, world peace.
Well, world peace more than ever now.
As I know, as general and abstract as that may be, there's a reason why it's become a cliche.
Yeah.
That's because it's never stopped being true.
Yeah.
It's depressing. It's depressing. I'm sure there's an element of every generation at every point in time thinking their times are the worst. You know, their times are worse than everything else. And that's perfectly natural because you live in the time in which you are.
Mm.
What you're dealing with, but right now I don't know whether it's the worst, I don't know whether it's not the worst. All I know is it's some of the things one sees going on are absolutely terrible. And if it's a wish, oh, thank you for that permission. I wish it would all go away. I wish it would all go
away. Yeah, it goes back to maybe you like to work with people that are open and want to see each other's perspectives.
Absolutely.
That would be a start.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Hey, Femi, thank you so much for this discussion.
It was a real pleasure for me.
It was great fun having you in the podcast. Sorry to bombard you with the music questions.
Not at all. Not at all. Why would anybody mind the music questions?
No. Okay, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
So did I. Thank you again.
Wishing you all the best in your career and with the admin tribunals that you are serving at the moment.
Well done.
So, and with that, everyone, thank you for listening to another podcast, Impactful, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for lying. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.